You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 702, and we've got a super interesting guest on tonight. We've got Howard Wolfing of Half Japanese, Howard of the Slicky Boys, Howard of Under Heaven, Howard of Howard Wolf Media, and Howard's got a brand new book out. I believe it's out now. Howard, is the book out now?
It is out now.
It's called Dissenes and Discords, an anthology, and it is a collection of Howard's zine from back in the late 70s and early 80s. And it's real cool. I've checked it out. It's awesome. We're going to play a track that Howard was on, and we're going to come back and talk to Howard. Let's play a Slicky Boys track. This is their cover of the Grassroots, of a cover of an Italian band, Let's Live For Today, and we'll be right back.
When I think of all the worries people seem to find, and how they're in a hurry to complicate their minds by chasing after money and dreams that can't come true, I'm glad that we are different, we've better things to do. Let others plan their futures, I'm busy loving you. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
Hey, hey, hey.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
And don't worry about tomorrow, hey.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
Live for today. We were never meant to worry the way that people do, and I don't mean to hurry. As long as I'm with you, we'll take it nice and easy and use my simple plan. I'll be your loving woman, you'll be my loving man. We'll take the most from living, have pleasure while we can.
2, 3, 4.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
Hey, hey, hey.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
And don't worry about tomorrow, hey.
Sha-la-la-la-la, piange come.
Live for today. Beside me, baby, please come close to me. I got to have you now, please. Please, please, please. Give me some love. Give me some love. Give me some love. Give me some love. Gotta give me some love. Tomorrow, hey.
Sha la 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 la, piange come. Sha la 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 la, piange come.
And we are back. Howard, thanks for coming on the podcast, man. We're excited to have you on. You've got a super rich history, and you're still doing super interesting stuff, so thanks for coming on.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Howard, I want to kick this off in an unusual fashion. Is I was at your Mardi Gras party one year, okay. And Garth Smith of the Buzzcocks was there, you know.
Steve Garvey.
Anyways, so you know, like someone said to me, oh, you know, he's an original Buzzcock. I'm like, oh. And I was trying to play, like, I didn't want to punch the guy and have the guy say, oh, you were in the Buzzcocks and blah, blah, blah. So I was playing it cool. I'm like, yeah, so how about those 49ers or something? You know what I mean? And right. Then, like, he, like, left. And someone was like, why don't you ask him about the Buzzcocks? I'm like, I didn't want to, like, punish him. He's like, no, he loves to talk about the Buzzcocks. You definitely should ask him about the Buzzcocks. How does one walk that line between being a punisher and genuinely engaging in someone's art? You know what I'm saying?
It's an interesting question. Because actually, we were hanging out with Steve and his wife, Deb, last night. You know, they came out to John and Peter's to see this guy, Mike Viola, who had been in the Candy Butchers years and years and years ago. He's like, hey, Howard, can we sit down here? I'm like, yeah, our seats. Just talk about stuff. I don't know. When it comes to talking to him about stuff like that, it's mainly because I pull out weird stuff like, hey, I got this cassette when you backed up Nico, would you like autograph this for me? And he's like, oh, wow, I've never even seen this one. So I don't know, it's a, I, hmm, can we start this over? Can you edit out this bit? Because I'm just stumbling left, right, and center.
Howard, we are raw and live, but let's talk about your early
Okay.
history. So, Howard, you were born in like Northern Jersey or something, and then you moved to DC at a certain age, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I was born and raised in a place called Jersey City, which is across the Hudson River from Manhattan and connected by various tunnels and subways and bus routes and stuff like that. And I went to college in New Brunswick, New Jersey, so that's Central Jersey, and moved from there to DC right out of college and stayed there for
And
about 10 years.
what was the impetus to move down to DC? And what year was that, like 78, 77? When did you move down to DC?
That would have been 1975. The impetus was a lady asked me, do you really want to go to law school or what would you rather do? And I said, like, I'd like to be a rock critic. And she said, well, if we get married and move to DC, then I'll get a day job and you can do that. And I thought, that sounds like a good deal. So that's what I did.
So is that it? Was that the impetus of the scenes? Like, is that what kicked that off, or how they get kicked off the scenes?
The way that got kicked off is when we were trying to really sort of cultivate and nurture a scene in DC, and we were starting basically with nothing. No places to play, no bands, nothing. And finally got like a place that would let us play like a band or two. I was like in one of those bands playing the punk night. It's like a Tuesday or Wednesday at the Keg on Wisconsin Avenue. And then sort of everyone else started showing up at these things because it was like, here's a punk thing to do. You know, punk night, wear your punk clothes, which in those days just meant sort of thrift store stuff that usually had holes in it and it might draw on it and stuff like that. It was all handmade stuff. And the local, you know, media wasn't covering it. You know, the Washington Post, if they would cover punk stuff, it was usually in a very derogatory manner. Oh, look at the fashion. Their clothes are ripped. They wear dog collars. You know, boo-hoo. You know, it's. And the other thing of the Unicorn Times, which was, it was a regional entertainment paper. So in this area, the closest thing like it that people might remember is, the Aquarian in Jersey. So all sorts of places had papers like this, and they didn't cover it either. Even though I wrote for them and they let me write about punk, but the local punk, not so much. And we thought that you know, this deserved to recognition and coverage and encouragement. And on a trip up to New York, because that's where my, you know, my parents still lived in Jersey across the river. You know, went up there, wanted to see the CBGB's place, which sounded like really interesting. Had a pretty peak experience the first time I walked in the door. You know, no bands on there that I knew, and wound up including the Ramones, which, you know, nothing to prepare you for. It was like a very shocking and amazing thing to like see, and also very, really sort of like fired me up. And I came across in one of the New York record stores, because, you know, also like checking those out, a thing called New York Rocker, which was a fanzine. It was tabloid, black and white. I think they had maybe color. The magazine's name on the front was in color, but everything else was just black and white. And I'm reading it and it's like, wow, I've never heard of any of these bands. It was clear none of them were signed. And I also realized in some cases, the writers were people in other bands. And I thought, like, wow, this is amazing. This is really cool. You know, we should have that. Just like I thought, like, we should have a place like CBGB's. And that was kind of the Keg. That was like, you know, our toe in the door. And D Scenes was our New York rocker. You know, we're trying to do for DC what New York Rocker did for New York. And that was the impetus. And we got through like six issues.
When you saw the Ramones, that's like 76 or 77. What were the Ramones like then?
Well, you know, we're like sitting there and seeing all these, you know, it's a CBGB's bill. So there's like, what, like five, six people on there. Never heard of any of these names. And maybe like second or third band in, like four guys come out, all dressed in like tight ripped jeans and like t-shirts and leather jackets and like not especially, you know, longish hair, but not especially long hair. And I just look at them and go like, wow, it's a band where everyone's dressed like Iggy Pop. This is cool. Let's hear this. And, you know, there was nothing to prepare you for it. So it just seemed impossibly loud, impossibly fast, and impossibly great.
Now you said that you were in a band down in DC when you started throwing. Which band was that when you were down in DC and you were in a band?
This was a band called The Look. They're the ones that had the residency at the Keg. You know, it was a cover band basically. I think we had one or two originals eventually that I wrote, but you know, cause I've had this discussion with people like Ian MacKay. Because there were show bands. Show bands were people who played covers, but they were like top 10 hits. That's what they played. The Look and some of the other early bands, we played covers because we didn't know you could write your own songs. You know, this is something we learned pretty quick, but initially never even thought you could do that. And so they were just like really unpopular covers. It was like, you know, the Yardbirds and like early Who singles and the, you know, Monkeys, I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. And we would like meld that into a Roxy Music song that has exactly the same chords. And then also things that I heard on singles, because I'm buying singles from classified ads in the Village Voice. Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Ah, that's a great cover. Oh, but get that. Television. Wow, get that. And so like, let's do these songs too. These are cool songs. But they were not popular songs, so it was a differentiation, but it was also a way to like, because when you're learning songs, you learn how they work, you learn about the structure, and you realize like, okay, I see how this works, I could do this too, I just need to do it, you know, different chords, different words. And suddenly I'm writing songs for The Look and then for the Slicky Boys. And now by the time I got to the Nurses, you know, wrote a lot of songs.
I guess that arises about you. Are you like the architect of the DC punk scene? Like, would the DC punk scene maybe not exist without you throwing these shows and setting up these gigs?
I was one of them. I mean, if you want to talk, everyone played their own part. And if you took maybe three of those things out, they probably wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be like Steve Lorber, who was a DJ on WGTB, which is the Georgetown station, who had a show called Mystic Eyes, which, you know, like mid early 70s was like hardcore garage rock. You know, it's named after a song by the Them, a song that has like one line in it at the end of the song, like at the end of a 2 minute song. Because he was managing the Slicky Boys. He had set them up with a residency at the Keg. And I think he's the one who probably got that first booking for Overkill. And I think the Slicky Boys were on that bill. And if not, they were on a bill like soon thereafter. Got them a residency. They broke up. And, you know, it went to The Look because Steve Lorber said, like, why? Well, you know, I got this residency. Someone should do it. How about you guys? You know, and he liked the, you know, that we did all the, you know, Yardbirds and Kinks and things like that. And so, you know, we played a part, but, you know, everyone was important. Everyone that was in a band doing stuff that was unpopular. And, you know, even, you know, you'd fill a place, you know, you'd fill the place with like, it'd be like 20 people, maybe it would be like a great night, and still did it. And say, so, you know, D scenes just like was, what do putting a light on that, encouraging people, because, you know, a lot of people do cool things, but in isolation. And if they can learn that other people are doing the same thing, it's incredibly encouraging. You know, a lot of times you'll notice, maybe not so much anymore, but maybe someone will have like a really unique sound for a group, or just a person. And within a year, there's like 10 more just like it. And some of them are imitators, and some are just like, wow, I can't believe someone's getting away with that. Because that's what I've been doing. I can do it too. People will accept it. And so this was a way of like letting people see like what other people were doing. And I think people just, it made them feel good to be recognized, to think like, you know, we're just not, you know, playing Tuesday night in a stinky place with like bad beer and, you know, management harassing us all the time. It's like people appreciate it.
So, you know, you hear about like in LA, like punk rockers, whatever, be walking down the street and they get harassed and called Devo. Or in England, if punk rockers be walking down the street, to people like, oh my God, you know, what an offense. What was this, you know, 76, 77, 78, what was the DC scene like for punks or punk music? Was it hated? Was it ignored? What was the, I guess, what was the interaction like with the quote outside world?
Well, the thing is, by like 78, there's already basically two generations of DC punks like running around, you know. So you had the first squad, people like, you know, that I was part of. So like the Slicky Boys and Overkill, and folks like that. And most of us had jobs and lived in the suburbs because that was the cheapest place you could live in those days. You know, downtown DC was like was more expensive or just kind of a wreck. And then you had people who were about 10 years younger, still in high school, who start getting into this music. And, you know, they're hanging out because, you know, when you're a kid, you hang out. That's what you do. You know, you're not staying at home like working on stuff. You're walking around with your pals. So these folks are like walking around Georgetown because they mainly live sort of up Wisconsin Avenue. And this was a natural place to go. There's shops and ice cream shops and bookstores and clothes stores and things that, you know, you like to see. And it's also where all the people from the military bases in the area hung out. And, you know, there was a lot of friction, you know, between those, the military people getting drunk and hanging out and that batch of punk kids, because by that time, you know, they had a uniform. You know, it's like Malcolm McLaren saw Richard Hell and said, like, this is great. Come with me to, like, England and you'll be a star. And Richard Hell's like, I don't think so. And, you know, McLaren says, I'll do the next best thing. I'm just going to take the way you look, spiky hair and ripped up shirts, and except I'll manufacture them and sell them instead of just like going to the secondhand stores and like and messing with it. And, you know, because he was very focused on being in the media, very focused on it, and had a flair, you know, for getting things that like happen and be visible. Unless this becomes visible in America before American punk really is. So this becomes the template for this next generation of kids, like looking like British punks, sounding like British punks, you know, initially and stuff like that. And they were easier to identify. The older punks just kind of look like disheveled, freaky people. They were hard, you know, we were hard to like figure out, like, what are these? Who are these people? What are they doing? And we're not hanging out in Georgetown. You know, we're rehearsing, we're writing, we're recording, we have jobs. So we're not like out and about. So we weren't a target. I mean, I'm sure if we were spending the time there, we would have been targets too. But it didn't turn out that way. And, you know, at the same time, when I talk about the fact that there were different generations, we're coexisting. You know, I've heard that in places, say like New York, that the older punks, the first batch, look down on the younger ones. I looked down on them and just didn't want anything to do with them. You know, when we saw these younger folks coming along, we're thinking like, great, this is spreading. This is really cool. Like, we're wanting this to get bigger. And to see, you know, a whole batch of other people doing it was like really happy and really exciting. And they'd come in saying like, hey, you know, I recorded my band. Do you want to hear it? And you'd be like, sure, Henry, let's hear your band. You know, take the tape, put it right, you know, in the record store, just put it right in the machine, listen to it. Like, yeah, that's really good, you know. You know, what about this for this part? Or what, you know, and we would have them like play with us, you know, when we, because that was, it was part of the ethos that we were trying to create this community that could be self-sustaining. And we understood that everyone was going to play a part. And the more people that were involved, the better it was going to be for everyone. You know, it wasn't like, oh, we want to have this thing to ourselves and we get all the gigs. It's like, no, how many people can we get involved in this stuff? So, you know, I remember like the Teen Idols opening for the Nurses and stuff like that. It's like, he's like, ah, I got a band and here's our tape. And like, hey, you want to open for us? I mean, none of us are making any money, so it didn't really matter. But, and I think, you know, people, that ethos spread to people, that really became a benchmark of how DC punk, you know, operated. You know, the first coverage you ever see of the Bad Brains was Martin Kane from the Slicky Boys, who saw them play a basement gig and wrote it up for D-Scenes. You know, he loved them. You know, we appreciated those guys, and they would, you know, I've been told that they appreciated the fact that we were happy to give them advice and to encourage them. And yeah, it turned out good.
And Howard was alluding to this, what's really cool about the D-Scenes compilation, if you will, is it starts, the first issue kind of starts before, you know, Bad Brains and Minor Threat and stuff. And then by issue, I think three, we see that first mention of Bad Brains, and we see kind of, I guess, the quote punk scene kind of become the hardcore scene in D-Scenes, and which is pretty cool. And along those lines, the compilation opens with a discussion between you and Ian MacKay. What's your relationship with Ian MacKay? Are you guys pals? Are you friendly associates? And how did you meet each other?
I like to think we're friendly associates. I mean, the reason that's in there is, you know, when we decided to cue this book up to get it ready to go and start really sort of putting it together, my wife, who runs DeWolf Publishing downstairs. So right now the downstairs is crowded with like piles and piles, boxes of books, because this is the warehouse, baby. That's why, you know, I'm motivated to sell these things and get these rooms back one by one. She's like, you know, get me some blurbs. I'm like, okay, like who from? Because like Henry Rollins and Ian MacKay. I'm like, okay. Right to Henry. 10 minutes later, there's the quote. Cool, thank you, man. Ask Ian, and a day goes by, and he calls, and he goes like, hey, you know, so I got this thing from you saying, you know, you like a quote. I have a better idea. How about we have a couple conversations, we record them, edit them, and we'll use that instead. I'm like, okay, sounds good.
Why do you think Ian would want to give himself more work instead of less work? Do you think he feels the zine is that important? I mean, because he could just come out and say, Howard's the best. The zine was great. Read it. Like, he could do that and get away with it. You know what I mean?
He could.
But instead, we've got this pretty interesting conversation. It's about, I don't know, 5 or 6 full pages, 7 pages.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty, actually. It's almost
and that 10. That's edited way down.
Yeah.
So, we talk for hours about stuff. I mean, because, you know, the first time I met him, he was a high school kid, you know, and he came to the record store that I worked at yesterday and today in Rockville. And he is one of those people that came in and asked questions, and we tried to give him answers and would like play things that like and ask, you know, for opinions, and, you know, we'd be encouraging. And I've just kind of known him since then.
There's a famous Yesterday and Today story that I don't know if you were part of or not. Yesterday was run by Skip Groff, right? That's who ran
Yeah,
Yesterday
the late
Today.
Skip Groff, yes.
And there's a famous story that and I think this is a Henry Rollins story where, like, if you asked him to play something, he wouldn't play it. But then one time, like, Jello Biafra came in and just, like, punished him for, like, 3 hours. Do you know about that story? Were you there when that happened?
I was not there when Jello came into the store and he did that.
I love Jello, and I love the stories of Jello just breaking people's will in half just with his sheer Jello-ness. So anyway, Howard, this zine is like, well, first, I'm going to just randomly mention some things here. First of all, the layout of the book is great, but the layout of the zine is actually super well done too. And really, like, it's almost like magazines and even zines kind of like don't have this level of craft anymore. So it's cool to see that. It's also really cool to see like the old ads, like the Yesterday and Today ad in here. And let's see here, like certain bands, Square One in here. And it's also cool when we have like bands not from DC make appearances in here, like Circle Jerks, Dead Kennedys and Half Japanese, the 930 Club, the Bong, oh, True Facts and the Insaniacs. That's pretty cool to read about them. So when you were going through these things, was it happy? Was it sad? Because a lot of people mentioned in here sadly aren't even alive anymore, you know.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, we're talking about two magazines because there were six issues of DC's in here, and that was totally focused on DC. And then there's eight issues of Discords, which is basically pointedly looking at underserved music scenes around the country. Just DC, we felt no one got signed out of DC. That was the ruling with wisdom. No one's going to get signed out of here. It's one of the impetuses for us to say, like, we're just going to make our own scene here for us because no one else cares. But we are going to enjoy ourselves and enjoy, you know, make something for our friends and all be a part of this because no one else cares. But we care about ourselves. And then thinking, this must be happening other places and trying to find those places and shine the light on those places then as well. You know, mainly my feeling was usually I was embarrassed at like what a snotball I was like on a regular basis. That was mainly what I felt. I mean, you know, the sad feelings I processed a long time ago. Yeah, that's just a fact. And I don't have a lot of nostalgia, just never did. In fact, the biggest time I've ever been hit with nostalgia for DC is when I went to Skip Groff's memorial. Because I had when I left DC, it's because I became a single father and I needed to go from having three jobs to support myself to one job because I had to be a father. You know, I couldn't just be out 24/7, you know, doing stuff because I was playing in bands, oddly enough, making money from that, writing for the Washington Post. Making a little money from that, not much. It's $25 a review. And working in a record store, you know, in DuPont Circle, and I needed one job, and I had to move to New Jersey to take that job, and it really sort of hurt me because being in DC was a great thing for me. You know, in New Jersey, you know, I'm a scrawny, weird person. It's like in Jersey is like. You know, I'm the one getting sand kicked in my face like 24/7. Go to DC, suddenly it's just like I'm just another weird, arty person. And there's, you know, lots of people like me, and we're all friends, and we have a community, and it's wonderful. And I had to leave that, and it really was traumatic. And I kind of buried that for a long time. But, Skip was a good friend of mine. And he helped me out a couple times when I needed some help, and basically giving me jobs when I, you know, was in dire need of jobs. And when he passed, that was heavy. It's kind of the first time I went back. I'd been in DC, but, you know, with other people, went to a DC oriented, DC punk oriented thing, and suddenly it's like everyone was there. Everyone I hadn't seen in 40 years, they were all there. And you know, it was a big deal. You know, I really kind of confronted the trauma I'd been carrying with me. I realized like how much it had hurt me and how great it was to see these people again and connect with them. And everyone was happy to see me and I was happy to see them. And yeah.
Which came first, Discord's the zine or Discord record label?
Same time,
So what?
basically.
Oh, so it's like the Dennis the Menace thing. How there's a Dennis the Menace in USA and Dennis the Menace in UK. It was just different origin, same name.
I perceived it that way. I mean, if you look at the D scenes, I had a column called Discords, which is every time I was talking about out of town bands. That's what Discords was. And I just sort of like, at a certain point when I decided to change the focus, Discords, because then it's all about out of town bands, becomes a big thing. Then you'll notice the DC scene report is called D Scenes. And suddenly the record label's there, and people, you know, would ask, like, "Whoa, how'd that happen?" I'm like, "I don't know." But I'm cool with it. I mean, you know, I like those people and they're putting out great records, so it's never really discussed it.
I'm going to wet the whistle of the listeners. I'm going to read a very short section from Discord's zine, and I don't know if Em's got any questions for Howard or not, but here's just a little brief excerpt from Discord. This is pretty cool. This is from Henry to Howard in the zine. I hope you're doing okay. I'm fine, thank you. It's been almost 3 months since I've been in Black Flag. We have just finished our album. It's called Damaged. It's got 15 songs on it. Being the singer of this band, I got a quick education on a lot of things. There are a lot of scammers trying to waste my time. People seem to like me. I have been christened the psycho. Girls don't seem to be too interested in me. I think I scare them. We work hard on Black Flag practice, phone calls, answering letters. We did a big press conference the other day because all the local radio and TV stations wanted to know why we had lost our MCA distribution deal. Of course, that's the famous Unicorn
Right.
Records thing. We were going to be distributed by the big MCA label, but at the last minute, Bergamo, the president, pulled out saying that our material was anti-parent and immoral. And of course, M, do you know where that famous quote was later used?
Where?
On
I
this,
don't.
on the
Oh,
sticker on the
parent. Oh,
back
yeah.
of
Yeah. That's
on the
right.
sticker on the back of
Parental
the
advisory.
original
Yeah.
version of Black Flag's Damage. So listen, people, the compilation, Discord, the scenes and discords, it's super awesome. It's got all these like fun bits of history, and also I really enjoyed a lot of it, but the two main things I really enjoyed is I enjoyed the look at pre Minor Threat, pre Teen Idols DC Punk, which I didn't really know a whole lot of, I knew almost nothing about, which is really cool. And then it's also fun to see kind of Circle Jerks, Black Flag, Dead Kennedys, UXA, Stains happening in real, Bad Brains happening in real times. And it's also awesome to see all these names pop up. You see Howard's name pop up. You see Tesco V, you see Henry, you see all these really, Ian MacKay right here has got an article about Black Flag, which is pretty cool. So it really is
Yeah,
a real.
and he took Henry with him to do the interview. If you look at it, like, yeah, he took Henry with him to do the interview.
Oh yeah, you're right. Oh yeah, right. And there's a picture of Dez, Greg, Chuck. It looks like on drums is Robo with hair, I think.
Probably.
And then there's a couple other people. So it's really fun. Oh, and Alec McKay pops up in the interview, which is kind of fun. So it
Yeah.
really is kind of this fun. Oh, and also what also is interesting is, you know, now I guess the definition of punk is sort of solidified, but there are articles here on Men Without Hats during their earliest era, which is kind of neat. And it just goes to show that, like, not everything was as divided then as it might be now, or thought of as being divided then. You know, there's also the Bongos are covered, and a lot of those other bands that maybe wouldn't be considered punk today, but are kind of alt rock or however you want to phrase it. So it's really, oh, Adam and the Ants article. So it's really super cool. Em, do you have any questions for Howard?
Which part of the book are you proudest of?
Well, I think I'm proudest of the introductions that I wound up writing anew for the book, because basically what would happen is, like, every day for 14 days I would read the issue, and then I'd like just write the introduction just right then and there. Didn't really revise it, and excuse me, and it was a chance to, I'm sorry again, it's a chance, I had a chance to, like, look at this and say, like, this is what we did right, this is what we did wrong, having some understanding of why we were doing it. And you can see there's like a sort of arc in attitude there that you go through, especially through these scenes where it's like super idealistic, it's super committed to, the ideal of building this community. And by the end, by the last issue, it's just like, we failed. Yeah, there's lots of bands, lots of places to play, but everyone just wants a career for themselves. And I note in this thing, it was like, and I was wrong. Because, like, 6 months later, suddenly Discord's Records is up and running, and the hardcore thing is starting to really sort of take off. And it's like, all those ideals exist at that point. I'm not claiming that it came from there. It came from, like, us, but suddenly all those things we were struggling to make happen and have part of how the DC scene would work, they made it work and made amazing music. And yeah. But it's nice to have that chance to go back and look at yourself and say, and have some sense of perspective and be able to admit where you're a goofball and point out, where it's like, hey, this is why we thought this and why we said this. And this is how it actually worked out, the historical perspective.
Well, I think it's cool to see Howard, the perhaps underappreciated architect of DC Punk. He's there. You look around, on the left side of the picture, there's Howard. You look at this band, there's Howard there. Howard is the string, and Howard can't say this himself because it would seem a little prideful, but Howard is the string, the glue of the early DC Punk. And really, DC Punk and their in essence hardcore as a whole would not be what it is without Howard. So Howard, thank you for your service. His book is out now, Descendes and Discords, an anthology. And Howard was kind of saying it's an expensive book, but it's a $38 book. That's not expensive for a book in 2025. It's got a ton of pages. It's super well laid out. So you should go check it out. You can check it out at dewolf.com. I dig it a whole lot. Howard, thanks for coming on the show. We're gonna
Thanks for having me.
and actually before we wrap up, Howard, anything else you want the people to know? Anything else you want the people to check out?
Well, go to dewolf.com, and there's like a batch of punk rock books on there. That's what DeWolf does. Most of them are oral histories. Most of them are written by people in bands, and it's a great catalog. It's great stuff. All done for love. I can assure you, never for money.
Well, it certainly showed that it was done for love through this excellent layout and comprehensive review of these zines. So let's play an Under Heaven track. Under Heaven was a band that Howard was in. There's actually a couple different versions of Under Heaven. This is among the earliest version. They've got a song called Time Does Not Confine Her. And listen to this lineup. Richie
Yes.
LaBrie on drums, Howard on bass and vocals, Don Zientara on guitars, and Ian MacKaye as engineer in 1982 at Inner Ear Studios. This is Time Does Not Confine Her by Under Heaven. Howard, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
They tell me time does not confine.
that was Howard Wolfling of Howard Wolfing, but also of Slicky Boys, of Chumps, of Nurses, of a bunch of other early DC bands that are probably a little bit underappreciated, you know. So yeah, that was Howard, M. That was Howard.
That was Howard. Howard was cool. He had a lot of cool stories.
Howard does have a lot of cool stories. And we're going to hit some cool and some not cool stories on the Punk News podcast tonight. Before we do that, M, briefly, let's talk about episode 700 is now in the can. It is being mixed as we speak. How was your episode 700 experience?
It was good. I'm really glad that I was on for like a bit of 500. So I kind of knew what to expect. Because I still have them. They're on like the side of my desk. But for 500 all that day, because I thought I was going to be like involved in all of the interviews for some reason, I did like copious notes and everything. So this time around, it was like, okay, you know, I've prepped for the ones that I'm driving. I know about the other ones, you know, I'm more kind of at ease that way. And I'm looking forward to just kind of taking everything as it comes. And everyone was really cool, like with the guests that we had on. Like, I think we did a really good job that way. Like, there are so many amazing, you know, little tidbits and stuff, like and meeting everybody. And obviously having the editor reconfiguration. I don't know. It was nice having everyone there. It was nice, like, you know, having you and Sam and Adam come in for a bit. And, you know, it was just a nice vibe. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. What was your thoughts?
I was glad Adam showed up. I was surprised at how, I wasn't surprised, but Adam was, at how it felt like we had been recording like 2 weeks ago. Like, it didn't feel like any time had passed at all, which was nice. I thought episode 700 was pretty cool. I think we got some cool guests. It actually wasn't as chaotic. Well, the end was a little chaotic, but it actually wasn't as chaotic as I thought it was going to be. The Penny Rimbaud, you know, interviewing Penny, you know, he's far out and you know, I'm always walking the line is, oh, I'm like really stupid compared to Penny Rimbaud. Or I'm like, or is he just doing like guru cult type talk and he's not really saying anything? You know what I mean? So I love Penny. I think Penny is absolutely one of the greatest, you know. So definitely check out episode 700. This is 702. And let's hit up some stories here. Em, you want to hit up the bummer story first or the bummer story left? Well, actually, is it a bummer story? Actually, well,
I don't think it's a bummer story.
Yeah, you're right. So let's just hit it. You know,
it's good news.
Well, is it good news? You know, that's the question. You know, certainly there's worse news. But so Ian Watkins, Ian Watkins of Lost Prophets has been doing time in jail for not only being a pedophile and a rapist, but being kind of like the worst pedophile and rapist there is, like doing stuff with babies and like really being as odious of a person as you can be, you know? So he was doing time in jail for 29 years for multiple counts of rape and sexual abuse and really bad stuff. Last year, he was attacked with a knife and survived. Well, this past weekend, he was attacked with a knife by two other inmates and was killed in a knife attack in prison. The two attackers have been charged with murder of Watkins. But, I mean, presumably they're on, you know, life without parole themselves. So, probably, I mean, like, it's like presumably they're not, like, losing anything, you know. And so people were celebratory, more generally people were celebratory about this. And they're like, he got what he deserved, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, other people, some hot take type people would be like, you know, well, is this how, you know, punk rock is about treating prisoners humanely, or at least it is to a lot of people. So is this not prisoners being treated humanely? You know, and you know, a lot, not all punk rockers, but a lot of punk rockers are against the death penalty. And this is, in essence, a death penalty of sorts, you know. However, you know, when punk rockers envision humane treatment of criminals or whatever, I think they're usually thinking about like drug dealers, or if not drug dealers, and just drug takers, you know. I don't think they're thinking about pedophiles and, you know, but then again, punk rockers will often espouse, mercy's the wrong word, will espouse, I guess, better treatment of criminals that have been convicted of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, attempted murder, and that kind of a thing, you know, or home invasion, illegal weapons. So M, what do we take from this? Like, it's an interesting point, but raised by the worst possible example you could ever pick ever to raise that point. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
But then again,
Yeah.
that's that's kind of the area where it's best to argue the point, is it with the worst possible example? Because that way, that really does ask, is this rule or belief that we have a valid rule or belief?
I think obviously like humane treatment of prisoners is very important because there are some places that are absolutely awful. But I don't think that's what this falls under. This falls under people taking justice into their own hands.
So you think people should be able to take justice in their own hands?
I think it depends on the case. And I think if there's somebody who has done very, 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 very like unspeakably awful things, and unquestionably they've done it, they are 100% guilty. There is no doubt about it. And their actions have ruined or taken the lives of others. They, if you want to, if you don't feel like the sentence or suited the crime, and you're, So I think that that's just something with that. It does feel very, it feels like the people who tried last year succeeded, because I remember last year when we were talking about it, and a lot of things that I was seeing online was like, oh, well, they, why didn't they like have better aim or whatever? And it's like, well, now they do. Now they did.
I'm surprised he wasn't in quote protective, like in America, like they put all the child molesters in like one area by themselves, because at least in American prisons, like being a child molester is like the worst thing, which it is the worst thing. And
Yeah.
so like you're in physical danger if you're a child molester in prison, so they put you in a different. I'm surprised that he wasn't, or maybe he was and someone figured out how to get in to get to him or something,
That's interesting. I didn't think about him being in a separate area, but he could have been. I don't really know. But yeah, no, there is no sympathy for anyone who's done anything like that.
Well, it's the end of the Ian Watkins story, I guess. I will say it's I didn't see this coming because in America, like child molesters, that they protect them or whatever in prison. It's almost like a movie, isn't it? Like the ending is very
Yeah.
much a movie, So yeah, man, I don't have any wisdom or anything. Actually, I will say one.
Okay.
Someone said this is clickbaity. Punk News is just trying to get clickbait. It's like, no, this is news because
No.
we covered it when he got arrested. If we cover it when he got arrested, we definitely got to cover the very end of the story. It's like that annoyed me a little bit, but whatever, man. That's news. I almost responded and then I
Yeah.
didn't, and I'm glad I didn't. You should never respond. Never respond to trolls then. Never.
Don't feed them.
Let's talk about something that's pretty cool. Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4 are back in print. And
Yeah.
I actually and M, guess how much they cost each?
Ooh, each. I'm gonna say they're pretty affordable. I'm gonna say $50.
Each?
Wait, no, $50 is too high.
Well, Canada money's different than USA money too. Are you thinking Canada
That's
money or
true.
USA money?
I was. Okay, let's do. Oh shoot, what's the conversion? I'm gonna say $25. I think that's very low.
At $28, which I would say is very
Okay,
reasonable. I mean, in
not
this
bad.
in 2005, $28. Actually, even in 2005, $28 for a record isn't insane, But in 2020, like, dude, like, guess how much Pink Floyd is selling their reissue of "Wish You Were Here" for? It's single disc "Wish You Were Here," Pink Floyd. This
Single
was
disc. Has it been remastered or any of that business?
no, but it's on color vinyl, but it has not been remastered.
$75?
Close, 60 bucks for a single
Oh,
record. Now, in
Jesus.
reality,
Okay, sure.
most new records now are like 32, 35, but some are like 40. Like if you go buy like Elton John's new record, it'll be like 40, 45 bucks. If you go buy like Tom Petty, not Tom Petty, like a Bruce Springsteen, it's gonna be like 40, 45 bucks. Really, punk is kind of where it's still, quote, cheap. And by cheap, I mean 28 to 35 bucks. Although, interestingly, some records still are $22. Anyway, I'm getting off track. I thought the $28 was very reasonable. I bought them as the I bought them literally the hour they announced them. They shipped them like I got them in like 2 days, which was pretty cool.
Oh,
The,
nice.
the and this is actually this I should point out why this is very important. This is very important because this is the very first time Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4 have been released on vinyl since their original release in what 1988, 1989, 1990, 1991, or whatever, or 93 rather. Like it's so really like before. Until last week, if you wanted a non-bootleg copy of Danzig 1, you're looking at $250, literally. Danzig 3, $300, you know.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And I got them, and I even though I have the original Zem, I've had the originals for some time, and actually I've got a sealed Danzig 4, which I want to sell because I don't want a sealed record. At any rate, I played them, and they actually sound super duper good. I was worried they were going to be like these Czech Republic records that
Okay.
like sound like crap. They sound awesome. One interesting thing though, who M, who do you think the copyright is associated with on the records? They originally came out on Deaf American slash American.
I'm gonna say it's not them. What's the label that they're out on now?
Well, Universal now.
Oh, okay. I don't think that's gonna be on there. I think it's gonna be just Glenn.
I thought it would be Glenn for sure because when you assign a record to a record label, you can get it back for free after 35 years, which it's called
Oh,
copyright
sure.
termination. So you
Yeah.
like no one knows this still. After 35 years, you can get your record back for free. And if you want more information about that, speak to Joseph at josephgentilelaw.com. And that's what I do all day. And I've done it very effectively for a number of clients. So I thought for sure that Danzig would get back his records because famously he doesn't reissue Samhain. He doesn't re he only reissues about 40% of Misfits, you know,
Right.
although he has been reissuing Danzig 5, 6, and 7 through Cleopatra. And the copyright is still up De American Records, Deaf American. So
Oh,
I'm like,
okay.
and then so I thought, well, I guess Danzig didn't take back his records, which was kind of foolish, you know, but I guess he didn't do it. But then the day after the records were announced, the Danzig social media started posting all about them, you see.
Oh,
So yeah,
okay.
I don't I so it's very interesting to me as to who owns the Danzig records. Copyright is a Deaf American or American, which means American owns them. So did Danzig maybe pull them back and then resell them back to American slash Universal? I don't know. You know, you would think he wouldn't because he's so protective of Samhain, you know, and even Misfits. And so then I thought, well, maybe since he already sold Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4 to a major label, he doesn't hold them as sacred as the reissuing, and that's why he won't reissue Samhain, but he'll resell. And this is all speculation. He'll resell Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4. I'm just very curious as to who owns Danzig's 1, 2, 3, and 4. Did Danzig sell back to Universal? And what prompted the reissue now, you know?
All very interesting, like, questions that I would like the answers to.
And the main reason why is it is so quote interesting, at least to me, is you know, if the Rolling Stones issued a record, it would not like blow my mind, you know. And they are issuing Black and Blue, which I'm very excited about. You know, if Minor Threat reissues their records, I wouldn't be surprised because they do that all the time, you know. If NOFX or No Doubt or Offspring reissue records, I wouldn't be shocked. I was shocked by this because Danzig famously hasn't reissued Danzig records, and here we are, you know, or Samhain records or certain Misfits records. So who knows?
Do you think this is going to be like the beginning of like maybe we will see like a Samhain release, or do you think he's like gearing up for a tour, or like do you think he's gearing up for anything, or do you think this is just like here it
Great,
is?
great question, Em. Great question. So I'll answer the easy one first. Is he gearing up
Okay.
for something? He's hinted at an East Coast tour next year. And so maybe he's realized that by reissuing
Oh.
these records, I can do the more. Em, guess how much Morse he was. Did I tell you this? Guess how much Morse he was
Oh
selling signed.
yeah.
Guess how much Morse he was selling signed records for on tour?
It was like over $100, right?
It was like three. It was 250 or 350,
Yeah.
$350. So maybe
Yeah.
Danzig's like, oh
Okay.
well, I can make a lot of $350 bills here, you know, just on, you know. So maybe the reach of the record is what prompted the tour, and he realized there's massive amounts of merch money there, massive. I mean, think about that, Em. A Danzig ticket's like
Yeah.
$50. He sells one signed Danzig record for $350. That's seven tickets right there. You know what I mean? All
Oh,
profit,
yeah.
mind you, all profit. You know. Minus $20, you know. So really it's even more than seven tickets. It's like 15 tickets, or 14 tickets. At any rate, do I think this will be the reissue of Samhain? I'm gonna say no, just because I'm gonna say no because the Danzig material, and in a way, and actually I talked about this before, is I've expressed frustration that Danzig wouldn't release Samhain and Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I was like, he should just call up Jack White and or whoever, but Jack White is a good example. Jack, I don't want to handle reissuing these. I know you'll do a good job. Just reissue these records and make them sound good, make them look good, and give me money. And I thought that would be the best case scenario, you know? But I can't speak to the financials, but I will say having a big label like Universal that doesn't do crappy pressed records, have them reissue Danzig 1, 2, 3, and 4, pretty sweet deal. The only comment I would have is no bonus tracks, no oral history, which all would have been very nice, especially to have these seminal records reissued. You know what I mean? And there are limited Danzig bonus tracks, but there are Danzig bonus tracks, which would be nice to see, you know, as a bonus to these albums. So,
Yeah, definitely.
and I'll point out that these records came with little pomp and circumstance. So to me, it's almost like. I mean, I know you don't go to the record store a lot, but you might go to the record store and say, oh, they reissued the B-52 second record. You know, like there's not like if Bob Dylan gets reissued, there's a massive media campaign. There's Rolling Stone interviews and so forth. But like B-52s, cool band, people love them. But to Universal, whoever, those records aren't that valuable. So they know people want them. So they'll just do reissues. They won't do any press. They'll just put them on, literally put them on the shelves and people will buy them in the store. You know what I mean? There's no real press push behind it. That's how they handle these Danzig records, which I can understand from their point. And most importantly, they sound good and look good. I would have liked to see a big celebration of these Danzig records, you know. But that being said, it's cool that you can get them on the shelf, you know. So yeah, that's my rant about Danzig. Again.
Well, he's doing stuff that's rantable, so that's always a good thing to see.
Indeed. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about here, Em?
What has been going on? Let's see.
Couple of things that I want to mention. We hit the, Dan Burt Dan Burt's going to go on tour. He's playing Philadelphia this Saturday. We're going to have an exclusive 8-inch record, which is going to be kind of cool. So come check that out. And then he's doing a West Coast tour after that. He'll be at the Punk Museum just the other day. Well, oh, how about this, Em? I think you're going to be not interested. I think you hate No Doubt. Don't you hate No Doubt?
I don't hate No Doubt.
I don't know how you
I
don't
like
love
No
No Doubt.
Doubt.
Oh,
I
you do
like
like
No
No Doubt.
Doubt.
Oh, really? Okay. Then are you excited about No Doubt plays Las Vegas? And at the Sphere. And do you know the deal with the Sphere in Las Vegas?
I know you project stuff over it
So
and like inside your track, it's like a 360 stage, I think.
everyone that
Is
I know
it?
that everyone that I know went that said it's amazing. I'm still skeptical, but what it is, it's a huge stadium, might be the right word, or venue. And it's like half a sphere, right? And you go inside, and while the band is playing, the entire sphere has video going on. So it's almost like disorientating, but that's disorientating is kind of a negative connotation. It's like you were totally immersed in the performance. So it's almost like two performances at once or multimedia, the band with the music, but then all this crazy video flying all around you. I think the original idea of the sphere was like, almost like a nature document. Like you'd go and you'd be like flying through the cosmos. You're going underwater or something like that. But
Like
they,
IMAX.
right, like, exactly. Actually, I'm glad you, like no one is mentioning it. It is literally just IMAX. But like everyone's like, oh, it's this brand new thing we've never seen before. Do you mean IMAX from like 1987? Do you mean IMAX? It's IMAX is what it is. But you know, very quickly got adapted to bands. I know someone that went and saw Grateful Dead or Dead and Company, who I can't stand, and they said it was absolutely amazing. So if Dead and Company is amazing, I can't imagine what it would do for No Doubt. Anyways,
Because there's other stuff going on, so you don't have to focus on the
true. Well, there is that one joke, and what did the Grateful Dead fan say after he quit drugs?
How could you tell?
Man, this band sucks. So anyway, that's an old joke. M, are you excited about this? Would you go see? And actually, I can think of an M Moore band that would be very fitting for the dome or the sphere.
Who?
My Chemical Romance, M.
They would, though. They would
Yeah.
have so much fun with that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
No, I can't.
It'd be
Because
wild.
I haven't seen
You
them,
should
that's
have
why I
seen
can't.
them. You should have seen them. You could have seen Alice Cooper and then MCR. You
I
could
could
have had a
have.
double whammy
A theatrical rock.
of
So, M,
theatrics.
would you go see No Doubt? And at what price point? Because you're probably going to be shocked when you find out what these prices are, M.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the tickets yet. I don't know what they would do for like a multimedia thing.
Yeah,
That's
that's
what's
like.
kind of like I don't know. I think they'd be great live. Like I think the band would be fine, but I don't know about like in such a busy venue, for again lack of a better word. If they were playing like a stadium or something, I'd rather go see that than this, just because I don't know what the visual component would be. And if it's just like you're sitting there and you're surrounded by flashing lights and there's no real story, then it's like, what's the point? You know?
Yeah,
So
like No Doubt
I
is
want to
not a
know.
No Doubt is not a particularly theatrical band. So like, I feel it'll just
No.
be like pictures of like oranges behind you, like flying around and stuff. You know what I mean?
How much are tickets? I'm scared to ask.
Go ahead and get. They haven't announced them yet, but there's been some leaks. So what do you
Okay.
think? What I'll say is actually like tier three tickets. You know, tier one is up front. You know what I mean? Tier three, what do you think those are going to cost them?
I think they're gonna cost 350.
Low.
Shit. 500?
600.
Oh gosh. Oh, that's not worth it. That's just one ticket.
Oh no, actually, I'm sorry. So I have defamed No Doubt.
Oh.
200 bucks. Still not,
Oh.
still,
Okay.
still.
Still very steep.
You know, it's funny. Like I saw 200 bucks. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of reasonable, I guess, for that. It's like, I would have 10 years ago, I would have been completely shocked at a $200 ticket. It just goes to show how quickly ticket prices have inflated to a crazy amount, you know.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Would you go see them at the Sphere?
For 200, I
Yeah.
actually I might. I've seen No Doubt twice. I've seen No Doubt twice during the quote original run, and actually it was within
Oh,
3 months
shit.
of each other. I saw them on the Push and Shove tour, and then I saw them. Actually, no, it would have been the Push and Shove. I don't think they toured on that. So I think it was between Hella Good and Push and Shove, and then I saw them do a full set at the Neil Young rock concert where they were all acoustic. They were totally amazing both times, and sadly that was almost 20 years ago now. Ugh. Not quite 20, more like 15, but still. Ugh. They were totally amazing. I probably would actually. I mean, depending, it had to be how much tickets cost. But you know, I mean, you know me, and I do not need much convincing to go to Vegas, except it's literally like a week before Punk Rock Bowling, so I can't really justify flying out and essentially playing. Like, the time you get tickets, hotel, and flying back and forth, you're looking at like $1,500. You know what I mean? Like, I can't justify that
Fair.
literally like a week before Punk Rock Bowling, you know? So.
Do you think there's any chance they're going to do the residency and then do something with Punk Rock Bowling? Or do you think it's just they're going to do the residency and then that's it?
Punk Rock Bowling is awesome. I love it. No Doubt is out of Punk Rock Bowling's price range. You
Okay.
know, I mean, No Doubt
Yeah.
is a multi-million dollar band to play. You know, I don't know that. I think Punk Rock Bowling pulls in a couple of million dollars tops overall. You
Sure.
know what I mean? So, like that's why like people would love to see Misfits play Punk Rock Bowling, and I would love to see it. I think it's just a little bit out of their price range, sadly. Now, Danzig.
He has reissues to promote.
Now there, that would be awesome if Danzig played Punk Rock Bowling. That might be like the best Punk Rock Bowling ever. Danzig, Iggy Pop, and I gotta pick it. All right, and let's play like my. I should. We shouldn't start getting talking about Punk Rock Bowling now. It's only October, but still. And pick your realistic, but
Oh,
pos
God.
Punk Rock Bowling headliners. I'll do.
Realistic but possible.
So
Okay.
you have to have at least one newish band, you know. Well, actually,
Yes.
that's not true because last year was Peter Hook, Social
Oh,
Distortion, and who?
Foxfire.
Cox, they're old guys, you know.
Yeah.
So I'll say Iggy Pop, Danzig, and let me think about who my third headliner would be. I mean, I could say like Surfboard, but like they're not big enough, you know what I mean? I would say Scout, but they're not big enough quite yet either. How about Emil? How about Emil and the Sniffers, Em? How about Danzig, Emil, the
Oh,
Sniffers,
that's a good one.
and Iggy Pop?
I like that. That's a good mix. I'm trying to do my like what fits. So I agree with Iggy Pop because that'd be freaking nuts. The second one I have is Bikini Kill because I think they're big enough and it would be really, really cool.
I think that's a good suggestion.
Thank you. And then my third one for like kind of a newer band, I'm just trying to like figure out, okay, who fits, like who's at that thing. Amyl and Sniffers is a really good one. Oh, but no, because they're not, that's the thing. It's so hard to be like, oh, it's this band, but they're really big here, but they're not really big here, and you know, whatever. So, because like, I don't think Pup, well, Pup would be a big draw, but I don't know if they'd be headlining draw.
I don't think Pup is big enough to headline
No.
while Rock Boeing.
No. So, it's funny. It's like now it's just there's no new bands I can think of.
Well, Em's gonna think about it, but
I couldn't think about it for a minute.
Danzig on Friday, Emil on Saturday. No, I got it backwards. Danzig on Saturday, Emil on Sunday, Iggy on Monday. That's the pick. Where is it Friday, Saturday,
Ooh.
and Sunday? Is it Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or is it? I think it's Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I think. I get there Thursday, I think. Anyways, I'm looking to Punk Rock Bowling for what if they announce to them and it's like Social Distortion and like two other bands I don't care about at all. You know what I mean? Like.
What if it's all social distortion?
Yeah, all three nights, same, and instead of advertising different set each night, they're like same set each night. All right, Em, let's do one more story, Em. What band do you want to talk about here, or what story do you want to talk about here?
Well, we're getting kind of close to Halloween, so we could talk about when did it come out? Oh gosh. Back. We could talk about. I'm just gonna have to search it. When did it happen? You know,
I
when you
don't know
think
you.
something happened like last week and it's like, nope, actually.
Oh,
Okay.
you mean like me graduating college?
That was yesterday. And I realized I didn't update this. They released a video for this and it's not up. But there is a band called Creeper, and they're really good. They've been around for, I don't know, quite a while. They're out of the UK, and they're releasing a concept album called Sangbivore 2, Mistress of Death, which is a follow-up to Sangbivore from 2023. So it stays in this era of like vampires, and it's very 80s influence, and it's very visual, and it's a lot of fun. So they released a video for one of their singles called Pray for the Night, and it has a lot of like different references. Like it has Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, it has The Shining, it has Night of the Demons, and a bunch of like really cool stuff. They also made all of their own like 80s food packaging to go into it and stuff. Really, really, really cool. But it's just so nice to see like Night of the Demons getting some love. Because that movie is great. That movie introduced me to Stigmata Martyr by Bauhaus, because that's a soundtrack for Angela's Dance and stuff. So it's a lot of fun, you know? And it's nice to see bands having fun with music and having fun with like the subject matter and everything. They released a video for another song too, Blood Magic, that has like a vampire orgy kind of thing. It's great. 10 out of 10.
Well, there you have it. Yeah. So listen, Em, it's been a busy few weeks at Punk News, I gotta say. The energy's running a little low between all the 700 stuff we've done and all the other stuff that we've been doing as
Yeah.
well. So yeah.
Oh, and there's a new Peaches album coming out, and the song's really cool. And I don't know why people don't like Peaches. Peaches is great.
Well,
Do you like Peaches?
Yeah, I like peaches. Some people love peaches. The reason peaches isn't bigger is because peaches is somewhat avant-garde and can be abrasive, which is what makes
Yeah.
peaches cool. It's like that Sparks documentary where the whole time the guy's like, why wasn't Sparks bigger? It's like, well, because they're like kind of weird. And, you know, meanwhile, people want like, you
Yeah.
know, Third Eye Blind or whatever, you know, or Oasis, you know, like that. That's why Sparks wasn't huge, you know. So yeah. Anything else you want to talk about, Em? Anything else that people should consider before we wrap up tonight's show?
There's lots of cool stuff on the site, and we're gonna hibernate for a little bit, probably in December.
And also, M is rapidly expanding her writing resume. She's writing for, not Spin, Exclaim.
Exclaim.
And also, she's doing press releases and bios. So if you want to pay M to do your press release or bio, email M at punknews.org and pay her some money. She's good at it. So there
Oh
you go.
yeah. Thanks.
And we, what, M, when are we going to see him?
Next week.